From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I cannot put into words how anguished and angered and ashamed I am by recurrent reports over the years of sexual exploitation and abuse by UN forces.
That was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking to journalists Wednesday about allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse of civilians by UN forces, most recently in the Central African Republic. He announced that he had accepted the resignation of his special representative and head of the UN Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in the Central African Republic, Babacar Gaye.
As you know, I have appointed a high-level external independent panel to look into more closely into the reports of sexual exploitation and abuse in the Central African Republic and our systemic response. I look forward to receiving their findings soon. I believe the disturbing number of allegations we have seen in many countries, but particularly in the Central African Republic, in the period before UN peacekeepers were deployed and since, speaks to the need to take action now. Enough is enough. Today, I have accepted resignation of my special representative, Mr. Babacar Gaye, head of the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in the Central African Republic, MINUSCA. As I do so, I want to pay tribute to General Gaye's tireless efforts in support of peace, security, and reconciliation over the course of a long and distinguished career, most recently in the Central African Republic under extremely challenging circumstances and throughout an unprecedented crisis. I want to be clear that this problem goes far beyond one mission or one conflict or one person. Sexual exploitation and abuse is a global scourge and systemic challenge that demands a systemic response.
Those actions followed the delivery to the UN of a report by Amnesty International, which detailed allegations of rape and murder by UN peacekeepers in the Central African Republic. Islamic State fighters ambushed a military convoy in Iraq's western Anbar province, killing at least 14 Iraqi soldiers. Roadside bombs targeted a military convoy Wednesday morning as it was traveling on a highway outside the city of Ramadi, which is controlled by the group, according to Iraqi officials. The attack in Qabaz, about 100 miles west of Ramadi, also wounded 10 soldiers. One Turkish soldier and two fighters from the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, were killed after an attack on a military outpost in Turkey's southeastern province of Diyarbakir. At least four additional soldiers and a local security contractor were wounded, according to official sources Wednesday. Those sources said the PKK fighters had fired a rocket-propelled grenade at the outpost, sparking a firefight. There's been a surge of violence during recent weeks between Turkish security forces and the PKK. And an Egyptian affiliate of ISIL in the Sinai province published a still photo of the beheaded body of what it said was a Croatian hostage. The group had threatened to kill the hostage last week. A caption said that the killing was due to his country's participation in the war against ISIL, quote, after the deadline expired, closed quote. The Egyptian Interior Ministry's press office said it was seeking to independently verify the claim. More reports about fragments recovered from the crash site of the Malaysian flight MH17 that was shot down over eastern Ukraine last summer. Dutch investigators now say that there are seven fragments that may be from a missile system, which they said were recovered from the crash site previously. CCTV's Tsao Young filed this report.
A new discovery based on a previous recovery mission.
We found seven pieces which we established that they were not a part of the airplane. And further investigation gives us now the conclusion that it's probably is part of a missile system and of a Buk missile system.
The chief investigator added the next step is to establish whether this could be the missile system which downed MH17.
If that is true, we have important material in the investigation which can help us to find out where was this missile coming from, who was in possession, where was it made.
Experts and Western governments have accused rebels of shooting down the passenger aircraft, while Moscow claims it was hit by a Ukrainian fighter jet rocket. Prosecutors said they would enlist the help of weapons and forensic experts to establish the origin of the parts.
We are not 100% sure at this moment, so that's why we are a little bit cautious in the conclusion. The further investigation we are going to do now is to establish that for sure.
Investigators are meeting with the Dutch Safety Board in the Netherlands this week to discuss progress and see a reconstruction of the remains of the aircraft. The board is expected to issue its final report in October, but not to apportion blame. Zhao Yang, CCTV.
As we reported previously, the Dutch investigators are looking into two possible scenarios.
We are investigating several scenarios. First of all, which is well known all over the world, is the scenario in which the flight MH17 was shot down by a Buk missile that was launched somewhere from the eastern Ukraine. And the second scenario we are investigating is the scenario in which a jet fighter with an air-to-air missile shot down flight MH17.
Nearly 40,000 people in Britain have signed a petition published on the UK Parliament's website calling on the government to arrest Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu upon his arrival in the UK. The petitioners seek Netanyahu's arrest for war crimes, including the massacre of over 2,000 Palestinian civilians during Israel's 50-day war on Gaza last year. Because the petition passed a 10,000 signature threshold, the British government is expected to respond to it within a day. If the petition gathers more than 100,000 signatures, it forces a debate on the matter in the parliament. Netanyahu is due in London on an official visit next month. Israel has rejected the petition as being meaningless. Press TV's Amina Taylor filed this report from London.
This is highly reminiscent of what happened in 2011 when then Justice Minister Zippy Livni was on an official tour, and the amount of murmurings there were that she was essentially running scared, moving from location to location to try and avoid activists who many had pledged publicly that they would carry out a citizen's arrest, I beg your pardon. And whilst the Israeli minister's office might be saying that this is irrelevant and it really doesn't matter, it must be extremely mortifying that a head of state is coming to a country where tens of thousands have vowed to support any action against him as a war criminal. And I think even for the prime minister's office at Downing Street, this must be something that has to be taken on board. And whether or not they want to acknowledge this publicly, that this is in fact a rather embarrassing situation and that the additional security parameters that will have to be observed just to ensure that somebody doesn't successfully carry out a citizen's arrest, well, that must be giving the Prime Minister's office at Downing Street a bit of a headache right now. And we have to remember fundamentally why this is. This is because before the re-election this year, Netanyahu's government oversaw one of the most barbaric bombardments of the besieged Gaza enclave, killing in excess of 2,000 individuals. And whether or not you have an opinion or a line on Israeli-Palestinian politics, the fact that mothers lost their children, that children became orphans, and that the region is once again being bombed back to the Stone Age must be something that resonates.
Tuesday marked the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the 1965 uprising in the Watts section of Los Angeles. Sparked by an arrest of a black motorist on August 11, 1965, the unrest continued for 6 days. When it was over, there were 34 deaths, 1,032 injuries, 3,438 arrests, and over $40 million in 1965 dollars in property damage. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. went to Los Angeles in the waning days of the unrest. Speaking at a press conference, he laid out the underlying causes of the anger that was evidenced during the uprising.
As President Johnson pointed out yesterday, it is a job of all Americans to right the wrongs from which such violence and disorder spring. The criminal responses which led to the tragic outbreaks of violence in Los Angeles are environmental and not racial. The economic deprivation, social isolation, inadequate housing, and general despair of thousands of Negroes teeming in northern and western ghettos are the ready seeds which give birth to tragic expressions of violence. By acts of commission and omission, none of us in this great country has done enough to remove injustice. I therefore humbly suggest that all of us accept our share of responsibility for these past days of anguish. I would like to work with the local leadership of Los Angeles in proposing programs for the eradication of those problems relating to housing, schools, jobs, and police behavior that were directly or indirectly related to the disorder.
In the aftermath of the 1965 Watts Uprising, California's then-governor, Edmund G. Brown, the father of the current governor of that state, impaneled a commission to look into the causes of the unrest. Its conclusions were nearly identical to the causes cited by Dr. King. 50 years later, unrest has broken out in cities across the country, and many of the same conditions cited as the causes of the unrest a half century prior face, in particular, black communities throughout the nation today. Dr. Anthony Montero is a scholar and activist. His academic work is focused on Marxism and race, with a particular focus on the work of W.E.B. Du Bois. He lives in Philadelphia, where he's active in social, economic, and political struggle. We spoke with him by telephone Wednesday. So it's the 50th anniversary of the Watts Uprising, and things haven't really changed that much. We're looking at the same thing again today.
Yeah, no question about it. There's some things we should say about the Watts Uprising, however. You know, it comes kind of at the end of what we call the civil rights decade, and it, in many ways, is the inauguration of the Black Power movement, which will then last another 15 years approximately. So, in a sense, they both emerge from a similar zeitgeist of resistance and protest, and represent different phases of that moment. However, we have experienced in the last, one might say, approximately 40 years, a kind of counter-revolution, a racial counter-revolution, which at the end of the day has left us pretty much where we were in 1965 when the Watts Uprising took place.
You know, we saw some gains in income and, you know, equity in housing, education and all of that in the 50-year interval, just like we saw in the post-Civil War period. But most of that's been eaten away, right?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting that you compare the two periods, the period of Reconstruction, what W.E.B. Du Bois called Black Reconstruction, approximately 1865 to 1877, and the period of Civil Rights and Black Power, approximately 1955 to 1980. And as you're aware, 1980 is the election of Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And all that that brought with it. But in the wake of both periods of upsurge and, I guess you would say, racial revolution, came a racial counter-revolution, which in the period after the Reconstruction of the 19th century pushed black folk back towards slavery through the mechanism of sharecropping and debt slavery. And this period, the great counter-revolution against black people has institutionalized the prison system, mass incarceration, police murders and killing, and really economic second-class citizenship for African Americans.
Yeah, you started to see the pushback before the dust had even settled with the election of Nixon based on support in the South and the realignment of the Southern strategy, and also in the streets in places like Boston and elsewhere over busing, which was a big symbolic issue at the time. And then with Reagan, you started to see the impoverishment of those who had, you know, started to get a piece of the American pie, and that is accelerated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, just like Barry Goldwater was a form of testing the waters and seeing if there was a white mass base for racial counter-revolution, as was George Wallace's campaigns for the presidency, testing the waters not only in the South, but seeing if there was a white working class constituency for racial counter-revolution. And of course, Boston in 1976-77 against busing, and Nixon's Southern strategy, which was a white racial strategy. All of those tested the waters, but I would say it is with Reagan that it is consolidated. And the white counter-revolution, the racial counter-revolution, went hand in hand with the crystallization of a new economic policy against the New Deal and the beginning of neoliberal capitalism, which then, of course, raises the great irony of, for many white working people, race and racial identity trumped class interest. And so while they were being galvanized in a counter-revolution against black civil rights, there was another counter-revolution against their economic interest called neoliberal capitalism.
Yeah, you had white workers trying to keep black workers out of the auto factories, for example, while the jobs were being sent abroad. And,
absolutely. Yeah. And while Reagan decertified the PATCO workers,
right,
which was the beginning of what we see, you know, in full bloom today, the decertification of public workers' contracts, as in Wisconsin.
Right. Looking at the landscape today with the uprisings that have been taking place again and perhaps the benefit of 50 years hindsight, do you see any more hope for what's assembling now than the last push?
The question is, do I see any more hope? I'm cautious, but I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, this current upsurge against police murders and police brutality is very important. However, there are stages that we have to go through in order for this movement to become a genuinely mass movement in the ways that the civil rights and black power movements were. You will recall that the front of struggle in the civil rights period included important organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Congress of Racial Equality, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and into that orbit came powerful unions like the United Automobile Workers. So you had this united front for civil rights and voting rights. In the Black Power period, there were important organizations. Of course, SNCC continued, but then there was the Great Black Panther Party, which I consider to be the high point of the Black Power movement, which galvanized a new level of ideological and political consciousness among the masses of black and white people. And all of this was occurring within the framework of the anti-Vietnam War movement and the demand that all of this military spending be ended, and that social services and anti-poverty be the focus of the government rather than war.
And those demands are certainly still appropriate today, perhaps even more so, but you don't see the same
kind of... No question about it. In fact, we are in a far more dangerous and reactionary period now than we were at the time of Reagan's election. In fact, I would suggest that in some form or another, we have to have the appearance or the development of an anti-authoritarian, anti-police state, anti-right-wing movement. And it has to be rooted in the grassroots, both black, white, Latino, Asian, Native American. But this is what we need. That's going to be a hell of a task to achieve.
Tuesday night, a symposium was held at the Solidarity Center in New York City, which focused on the connection between U.S. wars abroad and the economic crisis at home. One of those presenting was Larry Hamm, who chairs the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey, a city that saw a major uprising of its own in July of 1967. Hamm first reported about a rally against police violence and for jobs, peace, and justice held in Newark last month, which he said was the largest such demonstration in the history of that city.
And that is not an exaggeration. On the issue of police brutality, it was the largest demonstration that has ever been held in the city of Newark. And I just want to let the powers that be know that that is not going to be the last demonstration against police brutality, racial injustice, and economic inequality. I'm very honored to be here. I'm not an expert on foreign policy. I'm just a street corner agitator.
That's good.
But I do have a couple of things to say. First of all, the nation of Syria is an old country. It was old when the Bible was written. I just don't understand how the pipsqueak 200-year-old U.S. can go around the world telling these ancient nations how to handle their affairs. I think that that is a form of cultural imperialism. We should be trying to learn from these other ancient peoples whose countries and kingdoms were in existence before Europeans began their settler project here in North America. Regarding the deal with Iran, yes, I agree, it should be signed, but the people of Iran should look at that deal like the Native Americans look at deals the U.S. signed here in this country. You know, they give with one hand and they take away with the other. Mm-hmm. We had some delegates from Cuba visit us, and I think it's a tremendous accomplishment that we are normalizing relations with Cuba, and that is a victory for the Cuban people. But the struggle is not over. We need to end the embargo, end the sanctions against Cuba, just as we should end the sanctions against Iran. How can the U.S. dictate anything about nuclear weapons to Iran when we have more nuclear weapons than any other country on the face of the earth? We have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the earth scores of times over. I mean, it's a form of insanity, but we understand the insanity is dictated by those who control the madhouse. And it is a madhouse, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I don't care if the president is black or white. It's the policy that we're concerned about. And the policy, regardless of who's president, is a policy of U.S. imperialism designed to maintain U.S. hegemony over the entire world, as our sister pointed out. So the U.S. should not be dictating, but nonetheless, we agree with signing the deal with Iran. And I can remember over a year ago, and Sister Margaret spoke about it in her presentation, I can remember when the United States, when the Obama administration was on the verge of sending forces to Syria. But I can also remember that it was the people who rose up and said no war with Syria. That's why we don't have U.S. forces directly participating in the war there now. It's an indirect war. It's a war by proxy. And we say no war with Syria, hands off Syria, stop funding these groups that are trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And if people say, well, what should we do? Well, there's plenty to do here in the United States. There's plenty to do right here. I heard the professor Professor Musa say earlier that Syrian mothers worry about sending their children to school and worry about them returning home. Well, there are mothers right here in New York City that worry about sending their children to school and wonder if they're going to come home alive and in one piece. Instead of spending money to fund war in Syria, we should be spending it on jobs and health care and education and the needs of the people here in the United States. Now, that's easy to say, but the hard thing is to make that happen. And that is why the imperative for us at this time is to build a movement that links our local struggles to the international struggle. The struggle for peace in Syria is a struggle for peace here in the United States, because they are making war on working and poor people right here in the United States. I mean, right where we marched, you marched with us arm in arm in Newark, New Jersey. But in Newark, while this government takes our tax dollars and spends it for the manufacture of weapons that are used against the Palestinian people and the Iraqi people and the Afghan people and the Syrian people, they are closing schools. They're going to close 10 schools in Newark, New Jersey. They're closing hospitals. This year, they closed 3 hospitals. They closed Columbus Hospital, they closed St. James Hospital, and now they're talking about closing St. Michael's Hospital. They're closing schools, they're closing hospitals, they're closing factories. Northern New Jersey used to be an auto manufacturing center. Now they've closed auto plants, and the plants that are open are only able to do a limited amount of manufacturing. They're closing the factories, and they're closing our post offices, and they're foreclosing our homes. In Essex County, we have one of the highest rates of foreclosure in the nation. And we need to have mass demonstrations and marches for peace abroad and for the people's needs at home.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.